Work is so closely tied to our identity. And in the past year, those parts of our identities have been upended.
Millions of Canadians are without work during the pandemic. Some are fortunate enough to be working from home, and others still go into work every day.
And while we know that the economy, and with it jobs, will recover, we don't exactly know what work will look like after COVID-19. I'm Adam Toy.
And I'm Dave McIver. And this is Why.
It's no understatement to say that the nature of a lot of work done around the world irrevocably changed when the coronavirus pandemic hit.
When we first went into lockdown in March, I was in an administrative role. I was running my department. And so I was responsible for managing the shift of 50 faculty to online teaching within 3 days.
That's David Zweig, professor of organizational behavior at the University of Toronto. He studies how people work.
But before we go too much further, let's look at the trends that were already in place before March.
Well, certainly one of the bigger trends that we were seeing in organizations and in workspaces themselves is that shift to open office spaces, shared desks, hoteling, hot desking, whatever you want to call it. Now, obviously, that's going away and it may never return. And, you know, it was, you know, some of the shine was starting to wear off on that kind of method of organizing work, as appealing as it might have been to some. Really what it meant was that the organization saved costs in terms of office space and furniture. And it was, a lot of people found it very distracting and difficult to work in that kind of environment. So the shine was wearing off. And I think COVID basically, probably finished off that trend. We might actually see a reversal back to, cubicle type office spaces or proper walls or whatever it might be in order to allow for sufficient social distancing.
Yeah, and you mentioned cubicles. Those came in, if I recall correctly, in the 50s?
Yeah,
That's right. And so this is, as you said, it was individual office spaces, then cubicles, and toward this open office space. And now with the need for, or the evidence that, having a properly ventilated and isolated spaces for people to work, it means individual offices with walls. That seems to be what the trend is going towards. But I'm wondering if since people went into the initial lockdown in the spring, what you're hearing or what you've seen from corporations as far as the use of office space and whether or not they may continue to have it. Because, I mean, they sign on to these multi-year leases. What are they doing with
right.
the space?
I mean, if you go back and think about what we've all gone through, it's been this huge social experiment where we've had this seismic shift in the work from home landscape. Where before, some people engaged in some remote work, maybe 1 or 2 days a week, and that was tolerated by organizations. But people were pretty reluctant and suspicious around it, whether it would harm productivity. You even had some organizations who had work from home policies that, like Yahoo, that revoked them because they were seeing issues. But then we had this event, this seismic shift where everyone's working from home. For the most part, we've seen that people are maintaining their level of productivity. And if you talk to a lot of people, you find that people are saying they're working harder than ever before, which is an issue as well, because we blur the lines completely between our work and home lives. It's so easy for us to just, get up and go straight to work. We don't have that buffer of the commute anymore, before and after work to get ready for work and then disconnect from work. So we continue to work and we're working harder, and we've got to be really worried about that in terms of mental health and stress and burnout. Now, what does the future look like for work? I think it'll depend on, whatever an organization establishes as their work from home policy. There might be a broad policy. So for example, one of the big banks might set a policy for the organization. But I think there's going to be individual differences in different functional areas of the organization, and even at the level of, what your particular leader wants. So, your leader might want everyone back in the office and will apply, force or pressure to get everyone to conform to that. Others may be fine with continuing with the work from home arrangements that exist currently. So there's going to be a lot of back and forth. There's going to be a lot of negotiation. And there may be a lot of movement as people, you know, move around to organizations or workplaces that fit with what they want in terms of their working arrangements. Now, again, what that means for real estate, we'll see. I mean, if you think about what we talked about a few seconds ago around, you know, the shift away from open spaces, this might mean that organizations need more space rather than less in order to provide sufficient space for everyone in a safe manner. So we don't know. We're speculating. It's going to depend on a lot of different variables. I don't think we're going to see the end of downtown cores as we know them. We will see a return to the workplace. It may just not be as it was pre-pandemic.
So David, with that blurring of home and work lines and increased flexibility, is that flexibility necessarily a bad thing for organizations?
Well, the flexibility, what this has also done is it pushed a little more autonomy in a sense towards individual employees. It allows us, we have the freedom now, a little more freedom for the majority of our jobs to say, you know, I'll get all my work done. But I can decide when I'm getting my work done. And if we can manage that in a balanced way without sacrificing our health, that's a great thing because autonomy is really good for us. We like autonomy. We like to have freedom in deciding how we want to do things. Where organizations have to respond effectively and leaders, in essence, is understanding that, you know, being okay with that level of autonomy that people now have and changing their expectations or even how they measure performance. It's not that someone needs to be available from 9 to 5 anymore, and you need to like surveil them to make sure that they're working or they're online. It's that your performance measures change to fit with this new reality, that people are meeting deadlines, they're achieving the quality targets, and it doesn't really matter if they're doing it from 9 to 5 or they've chosen to do it from, you know, 8 to 4 or whenever it might be.
We're hearing now, and I think it was Bill Gates who recently said that in-person meetings are no longer going to be the gold standard for conducting business. Do you agree with that statement?
There's a lot of advantages to face-to-face. I mean, we can recreate it as best as possible through, you know, these technologies that we have. But there's a lot to be said for, you know, a lot of what we express and what we think and what we feel comes through in body language. And that's truncated right now because you can't really see what my hands are doing. You can't see my posture more or less. You can read my face right now. You can read my facial expressions, hear my tone, but it's a less rich medium than face-to-face. So we are losing a lot of that, information that we generally used to get from interacting with each other face to face and reading our body language and our cues. Now, you know, we often believe body language more than we believe the words that are coming out of people's mouths, right? Because most of us can consciously control the words that come out of our mouths, but we can't always control body language. So that's a very good indicator of what people are thinking and feeling. And we lose that with distributed technologies, and we lose that by not having face-to-face. So is the face-to-face meeting dead? I think it may be not dead. There will be times and opportunities where face-to-face will be necessary, but of course not as much as before.
So would it be fair to say that you think that travel for work-related reasons is not dead anymore, but will maybe be truncated, will be reduced?
Yeah, I think there's going to have to be a really, really good reason for travel, given that we've all adjusted to not traveling and conducting our work and engaging in our work without travel. Yeah, and so there may be the really good reasons for why you want to meet with someone face-to-face. Maybe it's to establish a relationship right off the bat to understand, you know, get a better sense of who they are and who you're dealing with in business. Maybe it's to close a huge deal and, you know, whatever is necessary. But other than that, yeah, of course travel will be truncated.
What about education? What are your thoughts on education and how that will be presented, you know, of the different levels, you know, grade school, high school, post-secondary?
I can talk about my own experience, my wife and I, with our two young children when school shut down. And it was generally awful. It wasn't effective at all. And I know things have improved, and, you know, virtual teachers have worked very hard to make virtual schooling much, much more engaging. But, you know, if the first lockdown is any indication, it wasn't great. Now, as I mentioned earlier, I was in charge of managing the rapid changeover to online learning in my department with 50 faculty and thousands of students. And we managed it. We did our very best to make the shift in a very short period of time. And I think now that it's become, you know, this is our existence, and it will be for the next few semesters, we've definitely found ways to adapt quite nicely to online teaching and online learning. That being said, I hope this isn't the status quo. I hope this doesn't stay the way that we deliver, because, you know, first of all, it's a lot of work to make online learning engaging and capture students' attention and make it have the same value as a face-to-face interaction. And you can do it, but it's very difficult. Fundamentally, being in a classroom with students, seeing their body language, how they're reacting to what you're saying, you know, knowing when you have a student who needs you to stop and explain something again, or to give another example, or allowing for group work, or that kind of, you know, work that allows them to take what we've taught them and integrate it. That's really important. So, you know, there might be some university administrators somewhere who see the benefits in terms of expenditures of online delivery as being more cost effective, but that's a very short-sighted view. You know, we can integrate online learning more, but there's no doubt that students benefit more from in-person learning.
It seems to me that there's an opportunity to allow for a school to embrace further of that online education that was happening before the pandemic and offer more courses online for folks who can't be in the classroom. If there's reduced costs of doing that, do you see online tuitions being maybe more cost effective for the student than in person?
There might be opportunities for that. And certainly, in terms of accessibility, it could be much better for particular students, depending on the situations. But, you know, if I was advising my own child right now, whether to, if they had a choice of going online or in person, I would certainly advise them that they would be better off attending classes in person.
What are your thoughts on gig work after the pandemic?
Well, I absolutely see it continuing, and it's going to grow, particularly now that, you know, if we get to the point where no one is going back to the workplace, we're not going to be limited by having employees who are, you know, located near us. We could hire people from around the world. And that was happening, of course, and this will certainly accelerate the trend of that happening. You know, the question is for the same questions that existed around gig work before still exist around, you know, what kind of benefits people have in this, what kind of, you know, how they manage the fact that their work is not that secure. They don't know how long things are going to last, and that sense of insecurity around that. So the same issues haven't gone away. And, you know, in fact, more of us are actually experiencing it now, given the situation.
David, I was also wondering, how do you think the study of organizational behavior will look back on this? How will the textbooks be written after this pandemic?
Well, you know, again, this was a huge social experiment. We're still learning about some of the outcomes of all of this. I think it'll depend a lot on what the default is after this is over. Whether this will be considered, you know, this year-long blip in how we managed work, or if this turns out to be the new reality of how we actually work. If it is the new reality, this raises huge questions about all of our assumptions around how an organization develops a culture and shares that culture and that shared understanding of what this place is like with people who have never stepped foot into the organization. So that's huge. So how do you socialize people in this kind of environment? How do you mentor people? How do you lead them effectively? It's going to fundamentally change the way that we as leaders interact with our followers, which it already has, and how we, you know, how we lead them. And for followers, you've got to figure out, well, how am I going to interact with this leader that I've never met in person, perhaps? And you know, I only see him on a screen or see her on a screen. And how am I going to be led by this person? So, you know, this is going to question everything. You know, even my own research where I study deviant behavior at work, so the bad things that people do at work. You know, I'm right now looking at, you know, that this phenomenon where people steal ideas and take credit for other people's ideas. Hmm. Well, how is that different now that we're not co-located? Does it still happen?
Right.
Or does it happen differently? And so these are questions we're all going to be asking about all the things that we've fundamentally taken for granted. But ultimately, you know, the basic theories around organizational behavior are still going to hold. What we really care about is how fairly I'm treated. Am I getting the same amount as someone who's doing a similar job to me? Does my company treat me well? Do I get along with my boss or my leader? All of these things are not going to change. So a lot is obviously changing, but a lot of the fundamental things that make our work life what they are still going to be there.
The questions around workplace culture I find really fascinating. Yeah. Because recently, a few years ago, I changed cities and I changed corporations and different offices, so very different cultures between them. And even within the corporation that I work for, Chorus Entertainment, they... between cities, they have different cultures within the building. Do you see assuming that this is the new normal, do you see more companies establishing a universal culture across all of the, if they've got multiple offices in multiple cities, do you see them trying to establish a universal culture across all of them? Or is there still that opportunity for the local local aspects of those culture, local expressions of those culture to come out?
I mean, every organization wants to believe that they have a one unifying culture. Yeah. But the reality is that subcultures exist within organizations and they will continue to exist because there's going to be unique either geographical or other factors that influence the expression of the culture in different locations, right? So that'll continue to exist. Often, you know, it depends. The culture is formed by the senior leaders of the organization. So, you know, for example, Chorus might have its, I think they're in Toronto, right?
Headquartered in Toronto, yes.
The culture that's expressed at the Toronto office of Chorus. But then you have leaders, you know, putting their own twist in Calgary, for example, about how that culture is expressed, which creates a, you know, might create a bit, little bit of difference. Ultimately, there's going to be a lot of congruence, but, you know, subcultures do form and that'll continue to happen.
And if assuming this is the new normal, those subcultures will likely form over, you know, distributed, like over video conferencing or chat.
That might be the only way, right? Which the issue is like, how do we, you know, how is you to, you as a new employee of this organization get a sense of what it's like to work around here when, you know, your exposure, a lot of where you learn that is just simply being in that space, seeing what goes on with others, seeing what the norms are, understanding what the values are. You may not be getting that through a Zoom meeting, right? You will get some of that, but it's going to be a lot more difficult.
Yeah, a lot more difficult to catch those nonverbal cues and even some of the unofficial chatter around the various meetings. Yeah,
for sure. Yeah. And we learn a lot just by watching what's going on around us. And that helps us understand what we do here and what we don't do here, what gets punished, what gets rewarded. Mm-hmm. And so we are losing out on that a bit.
This is Why is produced by me, Dave McIver, and Adam Toy. It's a national radio show and a podcast.
You can reach us by email, thisiswhy@globalnews.ca, and on Twitter at thisiswhy.
If you like what you hear and want to hear more, make sure you subscribe to This Is Why so you never miss an episode. We're available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you find your favorite podcasts. And if you like what you're hearing, tell a friend.
Thanks for listening. Wash your hands, stay home, and wear a mask. We'll see you soon.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.